Hello MQ fans, thank you very much for attending this presentation, which is MQ PubSub, JMS API and Traces. Let's go to page number 2. This is a list of related presentations about MQ PubSub. Let's go to page number 3. This tech doc has one zip file with files that are discussed in this presentation. And the included files are, for Unix, there are two files. One is called runmqjms and setmq903. These are shell scripts. For Windows, the equivalent for batch files. There are two JMS trace files that begin with mqjms_something and .trc. That's the end. And there is a configuration file called myjms.config. These files will be explained later on in the presentation. Let's go to page number 4. We'll examine the JMS API from the following MQ samples. JMS producer, which publishes a message. JMS consumer, which consumes a message in a manner that is non-durable subscriber. And traces were obtained from running the samples and will be briefly explained. In addition, I'm going to introduce you to the concept of the JNDI. We'll talk about two MQ samples that use the JNDI. They are the corresponding ones that publish a message and then the one that will be a non-durable subscriber. They are basically the produced JMS producer, but has extra code to handle the JNDI, and is called the JMS JNDI producer, and correspondingly the JMS JNDI consumer. Let's go to page 5. Okay, what is JMS? JMS stands for Java Messaging Service. It is an extension of Java specifically designed to interact with messaging systems such as MQ. And it supports both the point-to-point using queues and publish subscriber using topic strings. Let's go to page 6. MQ ships both the MQ classes for Java, which, by the way, they are deprecated in MQ version 9.0. And MQ ships also the MQ classes for JMS, which are recommended. I am including in this page a note that describes the deprecation of MQ classes for Java. Deprecation means that the code is still available, however, it is not going to be enhanced anymore, and therefore it's best to use the JMS classes. Let's go to page 7. Now, the question is, JMS is just Java with additional methods. How do you distinguish between a file that has source code for plain Java versus a file that has source code for Java and JMS? We cannot use the .java as a file extension because both use it. How do we distinguish? Well, you need to find out what type of methods they are being used. The MQ classes for Java use methods that begin with MQ. For example, if you open the source file and then just go to the top and start just scrolling down, you will see a section that has import. And if something begins with, it has com, IBM, MQ, MQ destination, or MQ message, MQ queue manager, that source file is using the MQ classes for Java. And remember, MQ classes for Java is deprecated starting with the version 9. Now, the source files that use the MQ classes for JMS use JMS in lowercase. For example, I'm including an import javax.jms.connection. Another way to find the JMS will be in import.com.ibm.com message.client.jms.jmsconnectionfactory. That will be the clue for you that this is a JMS source code. Let's go to page 8. And in this presentation, I'm using JMS samples that are shipped with MQ. And the location of the samples is different according to the platform. In Windows is the top directory of the MQ installation. And then the subdirectory will be tools, /gms/samples. And in Unix or Linux, it will be the top directory, /opth/mqm, and then /samp for samples, and then /jms/samples. Now, the samples in Unix and Linux are installing at different files. For example, in Linux, you need to include the during the installation the MQ series samples RPM. Let's go to page 9. Okay, let's try right now. I go into a pristine machine that has just MQ installed. I have not done any configuration. I go to the samples and I'm going to use Java JMS producer, and I specify the name of the queue manager, the name of the destination, the host name and port number. The invocation looks perfect. I make sure also that I have Java installed and is in the path and I can execute Java programs, which is a requisite. But then after I do the enter, there is something there that says Javalang no class def found error exception and class not found exception. Wow. If I do the corresponding thing in Windows, I will get a different error, but basically it's the same error: could not find or load main class JMS producer. Both of these tests fail. Well, what happened? Let's go to page 10. Well, the thing that you need to do in order to run any MQ application, either C, JMS, you have to set up the environment variables for MQ. And you do that with a command called setmqenv. Okay, for more details on that command, let's go to page number 11. By the way, this command is the same for Unix, Linux, and Windows. But in Unix, there is a peculiarity. The peculiarity in Unix is this. You need to what is called source, which means run inline, the utility by specifying a leading dot and a blank, and then the rest of the command. This is an extremely common pitfall. Most of the people, they don't do the dot and space or blank, and they just enter the commands. It looks like it's fine, but then they keep failing because this is a peculiarity that with the dot and blank, the command is going to set up some environment variables, and is going to, with the dot and the blank, it means that those environment variables set by the script will be remembered in the current session that you have. If you fail to specify the dot and the blank in Unix, what will happen is from your current session, let's say that this is a process ID of 123, a new mini session is spawned, temporary. Let's say process ID 546, and then the script setmqenv is executed there, the environment variables are placed there, and then it reaches the end of the setmqenv and terminates. That little session disappears. When you go back to the original process that had PID of 123, well, all that work that was done for setmqenv is gone. In order to avoid that, you need to do again dot space setmqenv. Now, this particular thing doesn't affect Windows. In Windows, you just specify the complete command, and the options are like a minus N, installation 1 or installation 2, and so on. If you have installed only one version of MQ in the machine, it will be installation 1. But still, you need to do it. And some people think, well, I have only one version of MQ installed in the machine. Why do I have to bother about this? Well, the thing is, we are preparing the machine just in case that you have a second installation. Then we don't want to make the assumptions. Maybe some people would like to use the second installation more often than the first one, and so on. That's the reason we are treating installation as equal, and you must specify which installation you want to use. Let's go to page 12. Now, there's a few other things that I will recommend to do, and that's the reason I will recommend for you to create a shell script in Unix or a corresponding batch file in Windows that will do this, the long invocation that you need to do. because I don't want to type every time /opt-mqm-setmqm-n-installation1. I don't want to type it. In addition, the setmqm does not set up some additional directories which will be nice to have. For example, the directories for the samples. And also, it doesn't include in the class path the current directory. And that's the reason I will recommend that, well, that's what I have in my test machines. For example, I have 4, 5, 6 different installations of MQ, and I just have something, a wrapper that I call it set-mq-75 or set-mq-80, set-mq-90 or 903, and so in this case, I'm using the latest release of the continuous delivery for MQ, which is 903. Now, the tricky part is you have to specify also with a dot and blank at the beginning. Why? Because eventually it has to use a dot and blank at the beginning for the setmqenv. Okay, let's go to page 13, and this is the equivalent for Windows. Again, we are going to just run the setmqenv command and add few directories into the path, like the directories for the samples. And the invocation is very simple, just set MQ903, for example. Let's go to page 14. Okay, what do you really gain with this command set MQEnv? Well, there will be updates to the class path, to the path, to the man path in Unix, which is for the location of the manual pages, and also the environment variables. And here I'm indicating some of those variables. Well, not some, all of the variables. For example, the MQ installation name, MQ installation path. And there are several that are related for Java. And that's the reason I wanted to really elaborate this thing, because sometimes people are just beginning to use MQ classes for JMS and JMS applications, and they fail because they don't have the proper environment variables. And instead of doing it by hand in the profile or in the bash RC, you can just run this the command setmqenv. Okay, let's go to page number 15. And okay, then this is one, according to the documentation in the manual for MQ online, the way you invoke an MQ JMS application is you have to specify Java space minus uppercase D and then Java library path, and you specify just in the placeholder. In that way, if you switch the installation names, you can just, you don't have to modify the invocation here. And at the end is, in this case, is JMS producer is just really the name of the application. Now, I don't like to type also the Java minus D, Java library path, and so on. Then I have created a wrapper. And this I'm going to discuss it in the next slides. And an additional thing about these wrappers is I'm going to just take a peek ahead of how to get traces. And get traces is a little bit tricky for MQJMS. And that's the reason I like to have the wrappers. In that way, I don't have to remember. I just have to remember that I have a wrapper, and then I have to do something to the wrapper in order to capture traces and what type of capturing, because there are several ways, and it will help me to remember. Let's go to page 16, and let's take a look at the wrapper. In this case, is the Windows. And in this case, there are three sections. The first one, it says, not using jms.config, and there are no properties. Then this is just the plain invocation of Java minus D, Java library path, and so on. And then they are, and one of them will be, the first one will be the name of the application, and so on. Now, this is the mode that I'm going to use for the next few slides. Later on, I'm going to use the other two. Now, there are two other sections. The section in the middle is commented out, and is one way of getting traces via a JMS configuration file. The other one, and the last section, is another way of getting the traces without the JMS configuration file. And the way to invoke it will be, for example, run MQJMS, that's the wrapper name, This is not an MQ command, okay? The run MQ JMS is just the wrapper. And then I specify the JMS producer and all the arguments that I need to do. Now, if I want to take the traces, what I have to do is go to the run MQ JMS batch file. I have to comment out the first section that it has the Java that is going to be executed. I have to comment it out, and then I have to uncomment the proper Java line that that I want to use. For example, the second option. Okay, let's go to page 17, and this is equivalent script for Unix. And again, it has three sections, and each section has the the first section is the corresponding ones for the Windows file that we saw in the previous slide. And the way to invoke it is the same. Run NQJMS and the name of the application sample and then the rest of the arguments. And let's go to page 18. We are ready. But let me take a little deviation in our tour. Even though we are talking about PubSub, I want to talk about queues right now, just for a couple of slides, because I want to show you something, okay? It is something that people who do not know about JMS, they get a little bit surprised when they start experimenting with MQ, especially if they have done experimentation with the C samples or C applications. And it's easier if I show you with a real example. Then let's run, let's have two messages. The first one is, let's run it with the C application of MQS put. And I call the text in the message test-1. And then I do another sample that is using the JMS producer, but with the flag of minus D means destination. And the Q1 will refer to the destination Q1. Okay, and I specify the name of the queue manager, where to get it, and all that stuff. Let's go to page 19. Okay. Now, for the step number 2, this is what we run it, how we run it. And the sample is basically asking you to enter a text, and I say test-2, and then it will prepare a message, and it will send you, show you a bunch of JMS attributes. Let's some of them at the beginning. For example, it says JMS message class, and there is JMS _ text. There could be bytes and objects and maps. But anyway, there are some other things that are mentioned here. There is the JMS message ID. Notice that it begins with the word ID and column. That's part of the message ID. This is the ID column before the 4 is not extra one. It is included in the message ID. Therefore, the JMS message ID is different than just... It maps to the message ID concept of the message descriptor, but it begins with ID uppercase and colon. Okay. Now the next line that I have highlighted here is the JMS destination. It doesn't say JMS queue or JMS topic. It uses the generic term destination. And notice how that is the queue, and notice how is specified. Is column // Q1, 3 slashes, okay? And then there is more information, and at the end it shows you that the test that is included, the payload is test-2, and then I didn't specify another text, therefore the program ends and it says success. Okay, so far so good. Let's go to page 20 and let me show you. I'm going to use the C sample code called MQSBCG to browse messages, and we have used that sample before. And let me show you what it looks like when we look at a message that was created by the C application of MQS put. The things that I wanted to highlight to you here is the following. In the message descriptor, which is the first part of the output of the browser application. It says format is called MQSTR for MQ string. That's what it means. And then at the bottom, it will say message, 6 bytes. And then we see in the right corner, test-1. So far, so good. We have a message descriptor and we have the payload, and the payload has only the text that we included when we created it. Let's go to page 21. Now, we go to see the second message from the output of MQSBCG, and wow, it looks different. The format, line format is in red there, just to highlight it, is called, the format has the string of MQHRF2, which means header for rules and format number version 2. Now, the things that I highlighted in red in the message contents, it is not really the contents of the message. The payload itself is just test-2 at the bottom, the last line. That's the real payload. But what happens here is an additional structure is added to the message in order to convey that this is a JMS message and it has a bunch of other properties. And that's called the RFH. And if you can see, the first line begins with RFH. That's the header. That indicates that that chunk of information is related to JMS. Let's go to page 22. I don't want to spend more time related about the handling of the RFH2. It's a complex topic. It's very complex. And there are many things. What happens if you want to read a JMS message from a C application and et cetera, and how to do compatibility. There are many knobs, twists and knobs and parameters that are specified in many different parts of MQ in order to deal with all the different aspects of the RFH2. I don't want to spend too much time here. The purpose of this slide in page 22 is to show you, if you are curious about the mapping between the properties and from JMS to the MQ properties, for CBase, then some things are mapped and some things are copied. And what happens when the receiving end is trying to do the mapping and the copying. But again, I'm not going to explain more about this RFH2. Let's go to page 23. What I want to show you is this. Let's take a look at the source code for the JMS producer.java. And what it's expecting is with the -d destination name is generic. It means that you can specify a queue, and there is an example there in which I just say the queue number, the queue named Q1, or you can specify a topic. You have to specify topic, column, slash, slice, and the name of the topic string that you want. Okay? That's, again, the same application is used to specify both Q and topic. And the source code knows how to deal with that. One of the things that you need to do is to keep in mind when working with JMS is the information on how the JMS application is going to contact the queue manager is in a structure called a connection factory. The connection factory is a collection of the information of what is the name of the queue manager, what is the host, which port, what is the channel, and few other attributes. And in this case, this sample, we have to tell what is the name of the queue manager, what is the name of the host, and the port number, and things like that. Let's go to page 24. This is an excerpt of the source code in order that shows you how the connection is created. An additional thing that we don't have in CBase is the concept of a session. In JMS, we connect, and then we open a session, And then we either open the topic or open the queue by doing the create and so on. We have to work with a session. And then we have to start the connection that starts the session also. Let's go to page 25. And then we can do the prepare of the message and do use the word send. That's the verb, the method, that will send the message for the producer towards the destination. And at the end, we just need to close the producer, the session, and the connection. It's very similar to the idea of we have an MQ connect in the C-base, and we have an MQ disconnect. This is the close. We have an open, and we have a close, and then we have the disconnect. Page number 26. Now, this is the another file, and this is the JMS consumer. This is a source code. It has the same idea, the same structure as the JMS producer, but instead of producing something, we are going to consume. Then the verb there will be, instead of creating a producer, we are doing a create consumer for the destination. And instead of doing the send method, we are going to receive it. Then that's the main difference. Let's go to page 27. Okay, now let's think of the following. Okay, now that I know that I can run successfully JMS producer, JMS consumer, and how do I do to get traces? Okay, in order to get the traces, we have to go to our wrapper and comment out the original first option that didn't have any options to arguments to do the trace, and we uncomment out the one that is going to use a JMS configuration file. And let's go to page 28. Okay, how do you get that configuration file? Well, the best way to do it is using one that is shipped with MQ. It's installed in your system. And the best way is just to do a copy. In this case, I'm going to put the configuration file in the /var/mqm. Then I go to /var/mqm, and then I do a copy of a file called jms.config, and I copy it to var/mqm. Now, it happens that I rename it to my jms.config, and then I have to make sure that it's readable. And then I have to edit things. The only thing that I'm going to edit there are only, sorry, the only two things that I'm going to edit in the file. If you look at the file, which by the way is included in the zip file that I have and that is provided for you, there are a bunch of comments, and there are some things that you can uncomment out. It tells you also what are the different attributes that you can set. This is very well documented. It's a long file, but it has, these are the proper values, this is a default, you don't specify, and so on, which is very nice. There are two things that I want to comment and modify the values. The first one is one that is the COM IBM message client common services trace status from off to on. In that way, is going to start the tracing. That's the first change. The second change that I like to do is the following. The default is the current directory where your application is located. That will be the place to put the trace file. In some cases, that's fine, but I like to put it in the /var/mqm/trace. And why? Because we have this tool that gathers all the files from the trace, is the runmq ras. If you specify the minus -devs trace, we'll gather also the JMS trace that is, if you send it over there. Notice that the name of the file itself has the PID, the process ID, inside the file name. In that way, you can generate several files, and you can identify each one, differentiate each one by the process ID. If you want to terminate the trace, then you can just change the trace status line from on to off. Let's go to page 29. right now the running QGMS is going to use the option that will invoke the JMS configuration file, and that configuration file has a status for trace of on, which means it's enabled. The trace is going to be enabled. The previous test we did was for a queue, and now we are going to do it for the topic. What we are going to do is the scenario. We are going to have two different windows. One window will be for the JMS consumer, and we started first because it has a timeout, and the other window will be for the JMS producer. We go to the first window, the one that has the JMS consumer, and we enter the command, and by doing that, then it will start listening to the topic sales. And so far, there are no messages there. Then it's just the clock is ticking for 30 seconds. And then we go quickly to the other window, and we enter the command for the JMS producer. And we enter one message, for example, test.jms, and press enter again to exit. And then we can see that from the JMS consumer window, we notice that we received that message. And let's go to page 30. And this is an example of the execution for the JMS producer. Then we can see highlighted in the middle and underscore JMS destination is the topic sales. The highlighted item at the bottom is the test.jms. That's our payload. And let's go to page 31. And I'm showing here what is the output for the execution of the consumer. Again, it's the same JMS destination and is displaying that we received the message. Let's go to page 32. Now let's take a look at the traces. In the directory for the traces, we got two trace files and some highlights in the files is unfortunately the information about the version and what command executed and so on is not really at the top, which is a pity. There is a lot of stuff that is frankly not relevant for MQL2 at the, and could be for a level 3. Then I have to scroll down quite a lot to find out, for example, what is the Java version. And it's important because some customers may use very ancient versions of Java that are no longer supported. And that's one example. The other one is the some Java command, which is exactly what the customer entered. Not the wrapper, but it's just the JMS consumer minus MQPS and so on. Then that's good to know sometimes. It's just, oh, you missed something there. That would be a possibility. Then you need to scroll down more in order to find out what is the version of the MQ classes that are mentioned here. I wanted to show you also how it looks like, some of the lines. For example, here when we are doing the last line in this page, it says create topic string and it's topic / sales. Okay, let's go to page 33. This is from the file for the traces for the producer. I wanted to show you about the create test message and how it's being sent, and then the corresponding for the consumer, how it is being received. Now let's go to page 34. The previous traces were gathered by using the JMS configuration file. Just in case that you wanted to capture the traces in your local directory and because you were experimenting or something, then you can modify the run-nq JMS script or batch file, comment out the first two options, and then uncomment the last option. In this case, you are going to execute the traces, the application, sorry, and the traces will be gathered in the current directory. Let's go to page 35. Okay, now we are shifting gears for a different theme, and is the following. I want to give you a motivation why we have to use something called JNDI, and so far I have not explained yet what it is, but let me tell you something. Let's suppose that the invocation for that sample JMS producer, let's suppose that you have 50 different scripts that use that invocation. Now, and you have hard-coded in those scripts the name of the host and the port number and so on, and there are 50 different scripts. I know, I'm exaggerating, but sometimes in some scenarios for MQ, pays to think in large numbers to see, okay, one or two numbers, well, probably I can do it this way, but 50, 100, 1,000, probably I will do it in a different way. And sometimes that will give you a better insight of why some things are with the product. In this case, for example, I'm thinking 50 different scripts, and I have to modify the line that says JMS producer, and I have to modify 50 times the name of the host and the port number. I don't want to do it. I'd rather just modify it only in one place, and that's it. Then that's the motivation for the J and the I. Let's go to page 36. And this is how the J and the I comes to the rescue, because instead of changing 50 scripts that use the JMS invocation, they will not have to change, because only one place will have to be modified, in this case, the J and the I. Now, assuming, again, that the application is running the J and the I, okay? Then let's go to page 37. And what is JNDI? It means Java Naming and Directory Interface. It's kind of an LDAP in a sense, which is Lightweight Directory Interface. It's a Java API for a directory service that allows Java software clients to discover and look up data and objects via name. It's very generic, okay? It can be used in many different things. Now, in JMS, the scope and usage of the J and the I is really narrow. It's really narrow. And it's used as a naming service to locate administer objects, which are created and configured by the system administrator. Some of these objects include the connection factory and the destination objects, like topics and queues. And let's go to page 38. Okay, now in this case, I'm just making it up. Let's suppose that we have a J and the I, and we have these two objects, the connection factory, and the name will be CF-QMPS. That's the name, the CF-QMPS, that's the name that will be known to the JMS application, and I will show you later. Now, in this case, again, there are maybe 15 different attributes for the connection factory. I'm showing only these six. What is the channel name? What is the connection name list, which is the host name and the port? What is the name of the queue manager? What is the type of transport, and so on? And the other object that I'm mentioning here is it's a topic that is called T-sales, and the topic string is sales, and we have a few other things like expiry or persistence or things like that. Okay, now this item number two at the bottom of this page says JMS application can refer to the connection factory CF-QMPS and a destination of T-sales in the above J and the I. Then when the JMS application is interacting with the JNDIs, for example, the application is asking the JNDI, hey, I have this name called CFQMPS. Tell me what is the host name. Then the JNDI will return with that information, okay? And the queue manager for this case will know that he is in a host called Mosquito, and the port number is 1424. And the topic string to use is sales. And let's go to page 39. But okay, what happens if now we have 50 different scripts and the application knows how to use JNDI, and now we are not hard coding there the host name and so on, and now we just have to change the queue manager from the host called Mosquito and port 1424 to another host in a different city, and it's called Venus, and the port number is 1435. That's the only change that we are going to do to the administer object in the JNDI. Okay? The application in the item number 4 in the middle of the page is the application keeps referring to the connection factory CFQMPS and the destination T-cells. There is no change at the application level. The JMS application is insulated from administrative changes. This is really nice. Okay? And there in item number 5 at the bottom of the page is the JNDI will return to the JMS application the new values. Okay? In this case, go to Venus host and the port number is 1435. Let's go to page 40. Now let's go to more deeper details about the JNDI. There are some these are some types of the JNDI implementations. The one that we are going to use in this presentation is called a file system, which is basically just one file. And the file is called dot bindings. Really weird name. It's kind of binding a name like the connection factory name with certain values at runtime. And that I can see that bindings. But it begins with dot. For Windows users, that's weird. Windows treats it as an extension, the dot bindings. In Unix, it's a hidden file. Then you have to use ls-a in order to show this file. It's a little bit weird. It seems that the designers for this API really wanted it not for users not to even know what it is and not to find it and so on, which I think was a little bit of an overkill on their part. Okay, the second item in this page is an application server. An application server will have its own JNDI implementation. In the case of the WebSphere application server, there are different files at different levels. The file name is resources.xml. There is a file like this at the server level, then at the node level, then at the cell level. I'm not going to discuss more about the WAS. The third item here is called the LDAP. It's a lightweight directory, and there is no more discussion in this presentation. Let's go to page 41. The easiest way to create and edit a file system JNDI, which is the dot bindings, is by using the MQ Explorer. Now, from the Navigator window, you have to scroll down to the bottom and see a new section, a section called JMS Administer Objects. And you do right-click and select, and then the option is Add Initial Context. What is that, Initial Context? Well, what it really means is the full path of the directory where the file.bindings will be located. That's what it really means. It is a legacy of the really general approach to JNDI. For JMS, the term initial context doesn't really have the original meaning. It's just, for us, it means the full path of the directory where the dot file, where the file dot bindings is located. Not the full path of the file, it's just the directory, but it has to be the full path. Then let's go to page 42. And in this case, I'm showing you the dialog from the MQ Explorer. Make sure that you select file system, the one in the middle. And then you navigate through the browser and you get the directory where you want to store it. That is the location. The one I'm showing at the bottom is, in this case, is /var/mqm/jndi-directory. I created that subdirectory, JNDI directory. It could be anything that you want, okay? There is no restriction on that naming. Let's go to page 43. And once you have created, you can, because potentially you could have multiple dot bindings files in different directories, then you could have different initial context places. In the way to select it, you just select it. It could be several options. Select it and then right click and it will be connect. And once you connect, then you can see the connection factories and destinations. Let's go to page 44. And let's visit the directory specified for this JNDI. I change to the directory, and I see that there is a .bindings file, and I can use Notepad in order to view it. Wow, I can see some names that I may recognize, but it is a long file. It has a lot of stuff. And on purpose, the designers decided to scramble up the order of the things. It's not a tiny little INI file that has orderly stuff. Here, the contents is just one attribute for one object is in the line number one. Then another item for another attribute for another item is in line number two, and so on. You cannot really see, understand the things. Then don't try. Don't touch this file directly. Okay, you have to use interfaces to use the contents of this file, and QExplorer is the best way. If you, as part of the troubleshooting, you get a .bindings from the customer, use MQExplorer in your system in order to look at it. Let's go to page 45. There is a utility in MQ that you can use for command line interaction, not for MQExplorer. It's called JMS Admin. It is rather cumbersome to set up, difficult to use. It's very unforgiving. It doesn't have a help. And if you misspell something, it's not going to tell you what are the different options or something. It's hard to deal with this. That's the reason I'm including two references here. One is, the first one is, it's a TechNote that is just to the point. It gives you an example of how to run JMS Admin. But it doesn't tell you more details. If you want more details, you can use an older tutorial, but it's still useful, and that's the second reference. Let's go to page 46. Here I'm indicating that the WebSphere application server has its own JNDI. It is not just the bindings file, it's the resource.xml file. And there is a tutorial that has a step-by-step of how you can create JMS administrative objects using the WebSphere application server admin console, and how you can test with MQ. It has also a test MDB that you can use to make sure. And the last chapter in this tutorial tells you how to use topics. When you are dealing with WAS, which is using the MQ JMS client libraries, and you are using with topic strings, it doesn't know how to use topic objects. Then when you specify, when you see a field that says topic, don't read topic object name, read topic string name. And that's what you need to enter. Let's go to page 47. There are some equivalent samples for MQ that know how to interact with the JNDI. And they are called JMS JNDI Producer and JMS JNDI Consumer. Both of them have a very streamlined way of invoking. First, it says minus I initial context. Remember, initial context just means that you need to specify the location of the directory. That's it, the directory, full path. And then you have to specify the minus C is the connection factory, which is the object that has the information, the, what is the name of the queue manager, the host name, and so on. And then the destination, which could be a queue or a topic. Let's go to page 48. I'm including the section of the source code that tells you how to handle the initial context, how to find out the JNDI, how to interact with it, and so on. It is kind of a cookie recipe. If you are creating your own JMS application, just borrow this section from the samples, and don't worry. You don't have to go to the Java manuals and try to find out the information, because it's a little bit hard. It's easier to start from a sample. And let's go to page 49. This is a scenario to run the JMS JNDI samples. As you can see, I'm specifying the full, when I specify the initial context, I have to include like file, colon, and C, colon, slash var, slash mqn, slash jndi, factory. If you are using LDAP, it will be LDAP something. If you are using another system, it will have a different first identifier. And then you specify the connection name and sales and the topic. And then in this case, the producer will just generate a random number, generate a piece of text, and that's the one that goes as a message that is published, and then the consumer is going just to display. And in this case, it will be, for example, JMS GNDR producer, your lucky number today is 90, but it could be that 90 is a random number. Let's go to page 50. Okay, this is the end of the presentation. Thank you very much.